Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Getting It Out Podcast. That was South Florida metallic hardcore band Ephemeral. The song Tower Has Fallen. It's off of their new EP, Tower of Silence, out now on Days Records. These guys came out of nowhere for me, out on my radar, and it draws influence, of course, from, like, you know, I hear some 100 Demons in there, maybe a little bit of Bolt Thrower, maybe a lot of Bolt Thrower. Perhaps some Morbid Angel, whatever you want to throw in there, a conglomeration of metal and hardcore, particularly death metal. All right, maybe you can throw in some crossover stuff, but no, let's just say it's metallic hardcore. That's the easiest way to do it, and I think it's pretty excellent. It's a 5-song EP with some pretty interesting orange artwork. Looks like there's a shot tower. What do they call that? What do they call those things for real? There's a big tower on the front and a pile of dead bodies underneath. So, might not even look like a hardcore record to some people, but it certainly is when you listen to it. Go pick it up now from Days. It's available digitally through Bandcamp or with a CD and, or on a CD, which comes with a, which can come with a poster, t-shirt, whatever, you know, all the combinations. It's available streaming everywhere as well. Again, they're from Florida, Metallica Hardcore, Ephemeral. Go check it out. New CD out now, Tower of Silence. All right. What's happening on this episode of the podcast? I've got an interview with Paris Mayhew, who, of course, you know from his high school band, his words, not mine, the Cro-Mags. But now he's got a new project, Agros. They released, he released his debut LP a few weeks back. It's called Rise of the Agros. And we're going to talk all about that. But first, let's go to New Jersey and visit the hottest zone there is with Hot Zone.
Kick it! Make family out of friends! Make friends out of enemies! Peace to my family! Make friends till they bury all the places we've been! We're never sitting it out! We be getting it in! Where you getting it out? I said all the places we've been! We're never sitting it out! We'll be getting it in! Where you getting it out? Get in and out!
I was out for a run yesterday. Just a casual old Monday evening run, and I'm feeling a little fat. Ate too much sugar yesterday. There was just sugar everywhere. Sometimes I'm at work and there's sugar everywhere and I can't resist. It's a problem. It's an actual addiction. But anyway, so I ate too much sugar, so I needed to go for a run like I normally would anyway, but I needed to combat some of that, the calories that I just threw on. And I'm out there running, not fast because I'm feeling bogged down. You know, I ate terribly. So I'm just running, but I'm determined to get the mileage in at least, and that'll make me feel better. And as I'm traveling down my normal path, this old man starts waving me down, saying something. You know, he's like, he's a little bit behind me. It was basically coming to a little intersection. He was down the other path, and he was like waving his arms up in the air, and he was yelling something at me. So usually I wouldn't stop. I think it's super annoying when somebody tries to stop you while you're running. Like, it doesn't make sense usually. So I think, well, maybe there's a problem. So I stop and, I turn around and ask him what's up. And he says, in 1984, I had insoles put in my shoes and I've used them ever since. Yeah, that's what he stopped me to tell me. And then he said, looks like you're having trouble with your knees because I wear the Chopac straps around my knees from my patellar tendonitis. I said, yes, sometimes my knees get a little flared up and a little painful, a little crunchy. And then he starts talking to me for a long time. And I just walked with him and I don't know what this was. I don't know how it happened. And I wasn't happy about it. I wasn't mean about it either, but I just can't wait to get to this age where you don't care what other people are doing. Where you're like, I'm ready to talk to you now. So here we go. And he just talked to me and told me that he's 79 years old, just had his hip replaced, used to smoke 3 packs a day, but he quit when he was 37. It took him a year to get over it, but he did. He's never been married because he can't say yes to a woman. He says he doesn't lie. So that's wrong. I got his joke wrong. He says he doesn't. His joke was he doesn't smoke. He doesn't drink. He doesn't curse and he doesn't do something else. But his one vice is that he lies. I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, that was a good one. That's clearly an old man joke. I've heard it before, but you forget it while you're in the throes of it. And then you get to the end. You're like, ah, yeah, the classic. I do lie. Anyway, he talked to me for quite a bit and he told me about his friend that he had who got married 5 times. Stuff that I don't need to know or care about and stuff that you don't need to know or care about. But I'm sharing with you the same way he shared with me. You just get caught captive in this little earlock and you got to listen to stuff about someone's life that doesn't matter to you. Although he was very nice. He did tell me he noticed that I was wearing a sweatband, which I was because I wear it's actually a shirt sleeve over my head when I run because I don't want the sweat to go in my eyes because then it burns. He's like, yeah, I understand that. He said, I ran 26 miles. I get a little sweat on my chest, maybe at best. That's it. I don't sweat. He said he got 3 shots in his heel for heel spurs. And the doctor told him if he wants to, he can scream. He doesn't mind. It happens all the time. And he said he didn't scream. He didn't scream once. He was born in 1944. They were men back then. I beg to differ. You weren't born a man in 1944. You were born a baby, later becoming a man probably in 1964. All right. So I think his math was a little off, but I understand the sentiment he was going for and I'm tired of it. What did these old people always got to tell us how manly they were? It's weird, man. It's weird. I think that's feminine to tell me how manly you are. It seems like there's holes in your story. Anyway, the guy was kind of nice and I talked to him for a while, but he did totally fuck up my run. And I just came home after that. I ran like a half mile more. I was like, well, I guess I'm going home. This is just ate up all my time I had for the day. And now I'm just pushing it forward. What do they call paying it forward to you? So you can hear my conversation with this old man. It went a lot farther than he thought it did. People all over the world now are going to know about this guy. I didn't get his name, by the way. 79, just had a hip replacement, walked a little funky. He was wearing a Camelback. I don't think that was necessary. Just hold a water bottle. I don't get what people think they need with their hands. He doesn't even have a phone. He didn't have a watch, nothing. How does he know where he's going? Must use the sun. Must use directions, north, south, east, west. Never eat shredded wheat. I bet that's how he does it. I don't know. I don't care. I do care about bringing you this episode, this conversation with Paris Mayhew. And as I mentioned in the opening, we're talking about the new record, Rise of the Aggros, and all the things that come along with it in Paris' journey making this new music. And we're going to get to that. But first, of course, you need to listen to a track. This one is the first single. It's called Chaos Magic. It features Chuck Linehan of the Crumbsuckers on guitar. Crumbsuckers rule. That band never got enough credit. People always cite Life of Dreams as the record, and it is. But Beast on My Back is great too. Despite the incredible cover art, one of the best cover arts for a hardcore crossover record ever, Beast on My Back, Bomb by Crumbsuckers. Anyway, let's not digress too far. This is Chaos Magic by Aggros. Hey, obviously, I know who you are, Paris. I'm very familiar with your work from the past, and then, well, of course, with Cro-Mags, and then now you're back. And I've been seeing this aggro stuff coming for about the last year, maybe. Has it been a year? How long have you been working on this?
It's hard to say how long I've been working on this. I just write songs in my, for pleasure. And so the songs that make up this new album that came out about a month and a half ago, I just, writing is an ongoing process. So it's hard to say, because this is not really a traditional band. It's more like a brand.
Right.
It's just a vehicle for my songs. And I hadn't really wanted to put my songs out for a long time. So I didn't have a vehicle for them before, in my earlier life, the vehicle for my songs was the Cro-Mags, and that was more of a band context. But essentially for me, that's all that was for me. It was just an ability to play my songs. And when I started writing songs again in recent times, I guess I initially, the knee jerk reaction was to try to form a traditional band, which I kind of did. I played with some people, and I wasn't really getting out of the situation what I wanted, which was really just to perform my songs. And so I just basically enlisted people in increments, to record stuff, to record mostly drum tracks, because there's five different drummers on the album. And I would enlist somebody with, show them a song that I wrote and then get it recorded. And then basically I just did that just out of interest to see how the songs would shape up. And then once I had the sessions recorded, I really just had them sitting on hard drives for sometimes a couple of years at a time. Mm-hmm. And I kind of collected all this stuff as puzzle pieces. And then when I found myself suddenly faced with it, I had about 7 or 8, or maybe more like 15 songs, but that I had 7 that I wanted to really focus on. I went into the studio with that hard drive and I just laid down all the rest of the tracks, and I brought a piano player in, and we did piano all over the record. And then I invited Chuck Lenahan from the Crumbsuckers to come and play. And then the next thing you know, I had an album. It was a very free, non-restricted process. I'm not on a record label. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what record labels do now. Like having, an 8-track tape player or making fire with sticks and stones. It just doesn't make sense anymore. So and also to a large extent, the record business was always set up as just kind of a way to, to manufacture and make a profit. And so as a result, you have these people that, musicians basically will do it for free. Mm-hmm. That's just the way it is. We never have any idea, especially when you're first starting out, you never have any idea that people will actually like it and it might make an impact on people for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. So they're just happy. They think success is getting a record deal. Like a lot of people think going to college is success or something, but it's not. It's just a platform to give you the opportunity for success. So unfortunately, because of that, the nature of the business is, artists get sucked into this record deal concept because they think that's success and they don't carefully read contracts before they go in, and record labels take advantage of them. I fortunately have had past experience with that, so I have no interest in it. I'm also a capable person. I wrote the album. I produce the album. I finance the album. I make the music videos. I direct the music videos. I shoot the music videos. In the past couple of nights, been out shooting footage from the latest music video for myself. And, I jokingly say they're elaborate selfies because, I just go out and I set up the camera and I point it at myself and I light myself with a monitor. Or if my wife comes out with me, I'll put the guitar on her and I'll light her and then we'll change places and things like that. Sounds very simple, but when you see the videos, I take a lot of time and care the same way I do with everything. So I'm not on a record label. And as a result of that freedom, the album came together at a pace that just fit my work schedule and my output schedule. You know, when I felt like working on something, I did. But I pretty much for almost a year worked every Saturday in the studio, putting this record together. I would just go in for on a Saturday for 10 hours every Saturday. It just became my routine with no schedule at all. And then next thing you know, oh, there's a song done. That one's finished. Oh, I guess I'll make a music video for that one while we work on another one. And I actually never intended to put it in an album because I kind of thought the album thing was antiquated. But a lot of people really love holding records in their hands, you know, making vinyl and CDs. And there are a lot of people driving around in their cars that still want CDs. So I found myself, I initially, when I first put out the first single, Chaos Magic, I said, that's the way I'm going to do it. I'm just going to do one song at a time. But all of a sudden I had all these songs, and it was enough to make an album. So I decided to release it that way. And then there's this other obstacle, you know, the manufacturing aspect of it. You know, when every time I contacted a manufacturing plant, they said 1 year.
Yeah. So if you're lucky. Yeah.
And it's not even like, I know I'm about to make a record. I'm going to go in the studio for 6 months. So I'll order the records now. And then you can deliver the tapes. They don't allow you to get in a queue. You must have a finished product when you hand it to them. And then it's a year, which is insane. Yeah. And of course that it's that way because, you know, resurgence of vinyl because of, you know, all these independent artists who thought, you know, it would be great to, you know, make vinyl. And there's been this kind of like underground resurgence. And of course the record labels witness this. And of course they jump in. And once they jump in, it's over for us because a little manufacturer says, oh, instead of making 500 for this person and 2000 for that one, the major label comes in and says, we want you to make 1 million Taylor Swift albums. So push everybody else back. You know, or however they make, I don't even know how many they make, but it's enough to have made every manufacturer take a year. And I actually manufactured my records in the Czech Republic.
Yeah. Yeah. I know a few people are doing them over there, and I usually get them and there'll be a little sticker on the back. This is made in Czech Republic. And I think that's cool. Whatever, however you got to do it. When people talk about the vinyl production delays, I always bring up, recently, I guess sometime in the past year, I went into a Walmart with my stepdaughter and we were looking through records just to pick my wife up some. And there was a stack. And when I say stack, I mean like laying the wrong way on top of each other, you know, stacked straight up about 2 feet high of just Adele records, the same record. And it was, and I thought it was, you know, ridiculous. And I'm amazed by this. And my stepdaughter, of course, she don't give a shit. But I just kept coming back to this spot. I was like, this is it. This is like the fucking representation of the issue, you know, because I don't think you can see. But if I tilt my camera, that it's records all along this basement here. So I'm very much into that. And just the production delays and just to see that visual representation was like, holy shit, it's right there. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's all worth, I mean, holding a record in your hand and like seeing, you know, because artwork for records has really kind of lost its value.
Yeah.
But when you see like, you know, just the same care that I put in making the music videos and stuff, seeking out artists like the guy who made this, Andrew Montserrat, he basically created like, you know, he even said to me, he goes, I said, what were you thinking when you made that? He goes, I just imagined lying down in the street and looking straight up. I love that.
Yeah, it works.
You got this this British artist named Andrew Sawyer, is also an Andrew, who made this. He's a comic book artist in London. And then Sean Taggart, you know, legendary hardcore.
Yeah, I thought that was him.
Yeah, he made this as well. So, but it's great to have this kind of thing and just be able to hold it in your hand. And the colored vinyl is awesome. You know, CD too, you know, the CD looks great.
Yeah.
Same art.
Yeah, well, I was actually listening. I think I listened a while back to you talking to Joe Hardcore and the This Is Hardcore podcast. And you had mentioned back then that you weren't going to do an album. So when this came out this year, I was a little bit surprised, but not totally. I mean, it makes sense too that, you know, that you eventually would do it. But I guess it came quicker than I was expecting.
I mean, things change, you know?
Yeah, of course.
I went in, you know, because I literally when I was on Joe's show, and I only had one song. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of like, I had made this thing and I'd been trying to form a band. And I had this idea in my mind, you know, the knee-jerk reaction is like, we think, you know, a band's got to be a certain way. I grew up listening to Kiss and Van Halen and Rush and like those those were bands, but they were always the same guys, and, you know, or they should have stayed that way. And you just get this idea that that's the way it's got to be. So by the time I completed Chaos Magic pretty much by myself, well, I had, you know, I had a drummer play on it, and I made the video for it. And I sat back and listened to it. I was, you know, I had this sudden realization that this is what I wanted to make. Mm-hmm. It, you know, getting a band together is just kind of like this, you know, the utilitarian way that people make music is they get together with a bunch of people and hopefully down the line they come up with something. But I had already come up with it, and I realized that there was no need to wait anymore. So I released the video and I started appearing on things like this, podcasts like this, to let people know that I'm kind of planting my flag again as a musician. But it's not in the same kind of like profit driven record company way that most people were used to. Like, you got a record out and you're promoting it to sell something. I was just saying, hi, I just made this song and I'm really proud of it. I hope you like it. Yeah. And even Joe, you know, Joe appreciated that because he knew, you know, he was well aware of Cro-Mags and interested in what I was doing. And he didn't care that I didn't have a record out. He just wanted to chat about all the things that he was curious about. And it was a great conversation. And I love this. I love meeting people like you and just talking about it. But, you know, the next thing you know, I had an album, you know, because again, I went into it at this leisurely pace. Nobody was prodding me along so they could make a profit. I think the result is just a record that I wanted to make exactly the way I wanted to make it. Like, this is the first time I've made this. This is my fourth album, and it's the only one that I've ever put out that I don't have regret attached to. Something, all these things are on the record that I don't like. I could have fixed this. This could have been better.
Well, you didn't have to compromise with this, right? This is all Paris.
No compromise, no debating, no nothing. Yeah. None of that. Yeah. And also, you know, the way it's set up, the machine to make records is really restrictive. You know, you go into a studio for a month or two. Mm-hmm. That's it. And at the end of that 60 days, you have to be done.
Right.
You know, no excuses. You know, I'm not produced albums. I produced an album for a band called Marauder. And one of the biggest, the hardest things to get through their heads was, this is it. This is all the time we have. You know, shut up, stop talking, stop eating, stop smoking pot, and set up your equipment and start playing immediately.
Come on, they're Marauder. They get to do that. That's part of Marauder.
Every conversation you're having with me, every argument you're having with me means one guitar solo is not getting recorded. We're not doing one more take of a vocal take, you know, that kind of thing. So that kind of thing, you know, you have someone, that's why you have someone like me go in there and produce a band like Marauder. Cause I have a sense of completion and I know how to pace it all out to make sure everything gets done. But they didn't really understand that, and it was very difficult. But fortunately I didn't have to face that. I just basically went into the studio every Saturday until it was done. And it was really kind of astonishing on that last day when me and the engineer looked at each other and we were like, okay, what do we do now? There's nothing else to do. We had like four or five more songs in the hard drives. But, you know, he said, you know, when you put a record on vinyl, the optimal sound quality is, you know, 16 minutes per side or something like that. So we stuck with 16 minutes per side to make a full length and make it sound the best it possibly could.
What is
it?
Does that play at 45 RPM then?
No, it's 33.
Okay. I don't know. I don't know what the time constraints are for 33 or 45 or whatever.
They give you all kinds of parameters, which seems strange to me because I remember listening to albums when I was younger that were much longer, but you know.
Yeah. That's what I'm thinking. I feel like you can get an hour on a record, but on a single record, but I don't know. But you're saying optimal. So that's different.
Yeah. To make it sound the best it can sound.
Yeah. 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 Well, the not having to compromise, it's one of the things that I always talk about, why I do this alone. Ever since I started doing this from the very beginning and the website I run, everybody's always been, well, you should get somebody else. Like, absolutely not. This is the way it's so much easier to do it by myself. I get to talk to whoever the fuck I want to talk to. It's just what I like, and And if it succeeds, doesn't succeed, whatever. That's all on me. You know, I don't, it's, and I think there's something really nice about it. Although sometimes I think we end up forgetting that it's, you're doing stuff for fun when you put all the pressure on yourself, but yeah, it comes and goes. But one thing I like to ask people who have kind of a solo project going is when you're working on these songs, when you're doing, when you're putting the record together, how do you, or do you easily come to the point where you know it's done?
Yeah. I mean, to a large extent, I just pick up the guitar and play with the bass. You know, when I play bass, I just completely immerse myself as a bass player. I don't think about the guitar. I don't think about the other instruments. I try to be the bass player of the band when I'm playing guitar. I try to be the guitar player on the band. When I compose on the piano, I try to just be that. You definitely arrive at it. It's, you know, to a large extent, when I used to write songs when I was in a band context, I would arrange the songs. You know, the music always came first with my high school band. And it was always just write the song to feel like it has dynamics and bridges and choruses and comes to a conclusion at the end without the vocals there. You know, to build a foundation for the vocals, you know, to create that sense of beginning, middle, and end without them having to do it, really. Not, you know, because to a large extent in the kind of music we play, you know, it's not like people go train to be a singer or to be a songwriter. They just kind of come in and brute force their way through it. And obviously we were successful at doing that, but part of that success, I think, was making sure there was a roadmap for them. You know, the songs felt like song before the vocals ever started. So I guess I trained as a songwriter in that context. So when I started writing these songs, I basically did the same thing. You know, the idea is just to create something that's energetic and exciting and dynamic before the vocals come, because whatever the vocals are going to be, you know, I always felt like I have to make it as great as it's going to be, you know, depending on how they're going to be. I never knew how they were going to be. I was never really a big fan of any of the singers that I had in my bands. So when I got to the, point where they felt like they were ready, they were beds for vocals, I started finding myself having little conversations in the music between the bass and the guitar. Like trading off, like where the bass really took the lead role in the band, and then the guitar would take the lead role in the band. And during the same period of time, I was taking piano lessons from this guy, Dirk, who's coming here later to give me a piano lesson. And he was giving me lessons for about 6 months. You know, I have a Rhodes piano that I've had. It's like, you know, ancient, and I had it in storage for like 25 years. And when I moved into this house, I said to my wife, I was like, do you mind if I put the Rhodes in the living room? And I didn't know how to play it at all. And she goes, of course, it's a beautiful instrument. So we put it in the living room. And then a couple of days later, I was on set at work. And I got a text from my wife and said, you have a piano lesson tomorrow at noon. You can't have a Rhodes in the living room and not know how to play it. I was like, wow, that's great. So my wife is German. So she found this German guy, Dirk, and he shows up one day and he sits down and we're just kind of like, I'm just following his lead, obviously, because he's a teacher. He's a, you know, classically trained guy, jazz musician. And he starts going, oh, so what songs do you like? You know, you want to learn how to play something? And I said, I don't know. I always liked, you know, that song that Prince plays in Purple Rain. It's not on the album. That supposedly his dad wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. And we went online and he taught me that. And that was kind of nice. And then he started trying to teach me Beatles songs and Bowie songs. And I got really bored really fast. And I said to him, I was like, you know, when I learned how to play guitar, and even to this day, like I've never picked up my guitar and played like a Led Zeppelin song or even a Rush song or anything. Van Halen, if you asked me to play one, I couldn't. You know, it's not like I'm a guy who picks up the guitar and plays Beatles songs or something. I don't know how to play anybody's songs but my own. I said to Derek, I was like, Leah, let's work on my songs. I'll show you something. You transpose it to the piano and then explain to me what I do musically as a songwriter. And I didn't realize how in depth that was going to be You know, the first thing he did was, you know, we sat down and played one chord from the song that I played. He goes, because you're playing this chord into this chord into this chord. You're doing, you know, it's like a 1-4-5 progression. It's a pretty traditional songwriting thing. He goes, but when you play the four chord, you're, you know, it's really diminished and you're implying this. And when you imply that, he goes and he starts playing, you know, this whole other thing. And to me, I said to him, I was like, wow, that's like a completely different scene in the movie. It's the same melody. You know, like when you see a movie and they have these melodic motifs and then you go into like a happier part of the scene, it's the same motif, mm-hmm. but played major. And then there's like a set, like where they get cancer at the end of the movie, you know, yeah. then it's all minor, but it's the same melody. And we started exploring this idea of the different scenes in the movies of the songs that I had written. And almost immediately, And I wanted to add piano to the band already. I'd already made some demos of me fumbling around on the roads, you know, and I'd written this simple melody, which ended up being one of the guitar parts in City Kids. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I wanted to play a piano outro on the record. So I had Dierkin here one day and I was playing this piano thing, this very rudimentary thing. And he goes, what's that? Is that like Thelonious Monk or something? And I said, no, it's just something I came up with. He goes, that's the only thing you've written on the piano. And you came up with those odd jazz chords. And I go, I don't know. It just appealed to me. And he goes, well, when you play this, you're really implying this. And he started playing and I was like, oh my God, I said, let's go into the studio tomorrow. So he took that motif that I wrote and he just expounded on it. And, we went into the studio and I had him improvise probably 10 times. And then I took those tracks and I edited them together into what's on the record. And that, you know, to me, I had, you know, I wanted that kind of thing, but it wasn't realized until I had somebody playing it. I mean, I was going to play it myself and it would have been probably 15 seconds long and it would have just been kind of like an echo of the song as opposed to it really being a proper different song, feeling like a different song, even though it is the same exact melody.
So is that the end of City Kids?
Yeah, the end of City Kids.
Yeah.
Okay. Which to me was, you know, I love this one. I'm not a big fan of the Black Crowes, but I love this one album called Amorica. Mm-hmm. And there's this one song on Amorica called Descending. And after you've heard like almost 12 spectacular songs by this band, but none of them anybody knows because there were no hits on the record. Except for, I think, there's one, but towards the end of the record, like the band just kind of fades off and it goes into this piano thing called Descending. And I just always loved that, you know, that feeling like that the band just kind of like stepped off the stage and that the piano took over. And I kind of use that as a model for the City Kids thing. So, you know, we arrived at that, and there were so many other things, you know, we put some other piano in City Kids and,
hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And I put sound effects that became part of the melodies. You know, I would just scour the internet for crazy sounds. And then you find a sound that just happens to ring out in an A note or a B note or something. Even at the end of City Kids, I found this submarine sound. Like, probably, no, I'm sure nobody would perceive it as a submarine sound, but the whole band hits this big diminished chord. It's really noisy. And then I started this submarine sound that's going ding, ding, ding. But it just happened to be a B note. And one day when Derek was over here, I was playing him and I was like, you know, I want you to do this. Da-dun-dun, you know, the Thelonious Monk type piano outro. And I was playing him the track and he goes, how is it going to come right after the track? I was like, I hit this big chord and then there's a submarine sound. And while he's sitting there listening, he just like reaches over the piano and he's like, ding. He's playing that B note of the submarine. Mm-hmm. Ding, ding. And then he starts playing the full chord. And then he just slowly transitions into the My Thelonious Monk thing. And I was like, that's it. You know, we just found it in that moment. It just because I liked the sound of that submarine sound, I didn't realize it was ringing out in harmony with the chord that I just hit. And it would lead directly into the piano part. So a lot of times these are happy accents, but as Dirk said, he goes, well, you did hear the beat. You wouldn't have put that on there if you didn't hear it that way. You know, you put it there because you thought it sounded good. And whether you knew that it was a B note or not, doesn't make a difference. And you also knew you wanted this piano part to come out and it's all in harmony. So it worked out really nice. So we definitely arrive to the point where the songs are finished. And there's definitely no master plan. It's just building it layer and layer upon layer until it feels like it's done.
I think I've heard you kind of talk about the way you do the music videos too. And it sounds like it's similar in that way as well.
Well, more so than most people know, because I started shooting the City Kids video way before the song was finished. Cause I had the drum tracks. And I was shooting stuff to the drum tracks and the rhythm guitar tracks. So like whenever you see the three shots of me playing, that was way before we even recorded any piano. And even before I added the second song, because it's really two songs back to back. There's a song called Ghosts of New York that's tagged on that goes kabam, bam, bam. And then that's when all the skateboarding starts happening. So one day when I was editing the video, I had this other song in a hard drive. And I had an MP3 of it and I didn't like the whole song. I only liked the last half. So I just chopped that MP3 and threw it into the video timeline at the end of City Kids.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I like that. That's good. And so I started shooting stuff of that and throwing it on there before I've even taken the session into the studio. So then I took the session into the studio, which was just guitar and drums. And I started layering the bass and all the other guitar tracks. And as soon as we had a mix of that, I took that and I just put that in the timeline for the music video. But I had already shot a ton of stuff already. So it's such a like organic, artistic endeavor that, you know, I never worried about the way it sounded because the MP3 sounded and it sounded pretty janky and terrible. But I knew that once I finished the recording, I would save myself all this time. You know, I have time now to shoot. So I shot and I was literally building that. I mean, it's a 9-minute long video. I was building that video for like months.
Yeah.
And recording at the same time. And then, so by the time the song was ready and mixed, what I did was I just took that track and laid it into the timeline and shifted it around until it matched. And then I ended up having to move the whole back of the video around and adjusting the shots individually, which was pretty time consuming. But with the actual finished track, and that's, you know, and then I focus on just finishing that music video. And that was the second one that I put out. And I hadn't even begun working on any of the songs for the album at the time when I put out City Kids. So again, I didn't have this idea, this vision that this was going to represent a whole album. I just really wanted to do it one at a time.
Well, it's obviously very well shot and you're the person to do that. And it's interesting how good you are at so many different things with this. You're clearly talented at many different things. And they're basically, as far as I know, all on display here, but you talk about the piano lessons. Is that the first like formal training you've had in anything or is everything else self-taught?
Everything is self-taught. The piano are the first formal lessons I ever had. And it's really kind of, I shame on me for waiting so long. Because, you know, I've been a musician all my life and the only time I've ever felt like doors had swung open and I suddenly understand music happened so recently that it's very strange. Like, I don't even know if I might have had the vision to make the songs as big as they are now.
Yeah.
To tell a story without without vocals, I might have continued to look for a singer thinking that was what you need to do. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I had two or three songs that felt completely complete that I realized that, you know, I'm just going to put them out this way because I'm listening to them over and over and I don't miss anything. And that's pretty much what I've gotten from a lot of people, is that people are just kind of astonished that they stopped waiting for vocals to happen. And they get so involved in this interplay with the instruments, which to me isn't that unusual. I mean, I listened to instrumental music a lot when I was growing up. I loved Brand X, a band Phil Collins played drums for, a little known jazz band. Mm-hmm. And the Dixie Dregs, I love them. And they're great at telling musical stories with multiple instruments. That's why I love the Dixie Dregs, because Steve Morse is just like virtuoso guitar player, probably the best guitar player ever. He's still alive, best guitar player. But he wrote for the violin. He wrote for the piano. He wrote for the drums. He composed these things so all these instruments could shine and tell stories. It wasn't just like an Yngwie Malmsteen thing where, you know, the Yngwie's music is just a base for him to
write,
which is awesome. You know, he actually does write good songs too, but nothing like the Dregs. So I had them as a model as well. And Brand X. I really like Brand X.
Well, that's interesting, because when I first looked at, you know, like just the idea of Agros, and like, oh, it's going to be instrumental and the songs are really long. Initially, I'm like, I don't know how that fucking works for hardcore metal, whatever bucket you want to put it in. But then I don't know how it works the other way. Now, once you listen to it, because I like a lot of prog stuff too. I like, maybe not always instrumental, but of course, you know, you listen to Yes, you're going to get big instrumental passages, whatever you want to call them. So like, now that I think about it, you can't do 3-minute songs. You could. I don't think you can be interesting and stay compelling and build like the intensity, the narrative with a short song. I think it has to be a long song. And I think that you show that here, because I look at the track list. It's you got one that's shorter, but most of them are over 6 minutes. Right. So I think that what initially I thought was a deterrent is actually part of what makes it cool.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't really thought about that, you know, because I definitely like City Kids initially wasn't that long until I added the Ghosts of New York thing at the end, and, you know, halfway through, and I did it because it felt like it needed it dynamically. And then all of a sudden I threw on a 2-minute long piano outro at the end as well.
Right.
And I remember when I was adding that, my wife was like, "You're going to make it longer." I don't know. This feels right. But you know, I'm glad you mentioned Yes too, because I'm a huge Yes fan. I mean, I never ever stop listening to Yes. I listen to Tales from Topographic Oceans in my car all the time.
Yeah.
I still Close to the Edge and Relayer. Really, those three albums: Close to the Edge, Relayer, and Tales from Topographic.
Oh, see, I'm Fragile, Close to the Edge, Relayer. Those are my three.
Well, you know what the problem with Tales from Topographic Oceans is? It's a double album, right? Mm-hmm. And one of those albums is great. It's only two songs. It's the Remembering and the Revealing Science of God, one song per side. And yep, they are the stellar, wonderful, as good as Yes has ever been. But then there's another album and it's awful. It's just some horseshit. Like, God knows what the fuck they were thinking. Like, why did they put out a double album of this crap second? So a lot of times when people listen to it, they can't get through that one disc and they think they don't like the album.
Yeah.
Just don't.
That might have happened to me.
Just listen to Revealing Science of God and the Remembering, and you'll say to yourself, my God, this is just as good as Relayer or Close to the Edge. I'm telling you, it's so good. And Going for the One is a great album too. Mm-hmm. And Tormato is a great album.
Yeah, I mean, some killer records. I have a jukebox in my garage with just, you know, 45s on it, and it's got like a portion of Close to the Edge, you know, the single version of it. And every time I listen to that, I'm like, now I need to go. The whole thing needs to go on, you know. I need to come inside and sit in front of the record player and put the actual album on, because like I'm kind of saying, even though that single version of Close to the Edge is cool, it's cooler when it's the whole expansive thing, you know, when you get the whole the whole thing in one shot, the whole record even. And I think that's the kind of the way I feel about like the aggros stuff. It's cool. Like you're writing cool riffs, you know, cool parts, but it's much cooler when you have the whole song, the whole record. Well, the whole song mostly.
Well, I mean, it's a lot. Sometimes it's hard to see the influences, especially if you don't have a vast musical background, and people know me from Cro-Mags and they just associate everything with that. But so much of the influence does come from bands like Yes, especially the arrangements and the scope of it. But you take a song like City Kids and the bass playing, I never would have played the bass the way I did on City Kids if I hadn't owned Close to the Edge. Mm-hmm. The bass parts in Siberian Katru. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, it's not the same, but it's the approach that Chris Squire had on that song is exactly what I was thinking about when I was playing the bass to City Kids. And, you know, most people would never make the connection between the two ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's so many, I have so many influence. Like I said, the Black Rose, who would have thought the Black Rose would influence my record? But, you know, and all the music that we grow up on, all those vinyls that are sitting behind you, they all have an imprint on you. They change the way you feel music can be. Mm-hmm. You listen to a record in your youth and it begins to forge an idea in your head of what music should be. Like, oh yeah, this is what it should be. And then you hear Master of Puppets and you're like, oh, that's what it should be.
And then that's pretty cool too.
Yeah. And you're like, that's the way it should be. And then you hear Prince or, you know, Muse or, you know, Slayer and all those, and all of a sudden you're getting all these like little inputs in your brain and the idea of what you think music is and what should be is mutated again and again and again. I mean, if you're receptive as life goes on, that idea of what music is and what music can be is continuously changing. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that separates my approach from most people in hardcore or heavy music at all is that I don't just draw my influences from hardcore and heavy metal music. I draw it from all the things that ever mutated my perception of what music should be, what be it Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young or, you know, or Slipknot or Van Halen or Rush. And all those bands had an effect on me. And now that I'm not in a room with five other people who had those same impressions, the problem with most people's impressions of what music should be is it's much more limited. You know, Cobbs, the drummer that I play with on this record, he wants to be in a death metal band. That's what he wants. That's all he wants. He hates AC/DC. Every time I say, this beat's more like an AC/DC beat, he looks at me and goes, I hate AC/DC. And I appreciate that. He's a super, super duper talented guy. And the thing that made him so great at what he does is his single-minded devotion to this idea of what he wants music to be. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to, you know, to argue with that, but it's problematic if you have a democracy.
Right. Right. Well, you don't. So that's good. That's good for this. We mentioned obviously that you're not doing the label. I know there's the Wildfire NYC thing you got, but
that's an imprint that me and my wife used to do business.
That's like, what I mean. I figured it was, you know, something.
A little film production company. We do some jobs and we call it, and my wife was like, oh, let's call the company Wildfire. And I love that idea. And then, so when we decided to do all this business for the merch and records and all that kind of stuff, we just put it under the moniker.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That indicates it's us because she does so much of the work for the band.
Gotcha. Well, one of my questions about that was, is that not being on a label, not doing it, is that the reason or is it just preference that you're not on most streaming services?
Well, we're not on any streaming services.
Yeah, I mean, I was including Bandcamp, I guess, because that's technically a streaming service.
They are a streaming service, but I don't stream my music on there. You can listen to every song three times.
Locks you out.
Then you purchase it. That's one of the models that they have there. And I thought that was great because, you know, I certainly would love people to hear it first. and like it and listen to it three times. And if they listen to it three times, they might want to get it. But streaming is something I will never do. Streaming is just a big, huge ripoff. It's a way, I mean, I know people love it because it's free and
it's convenient. And that's it.
Unfortunately, you know, people out there have been taught that music is worthless. Mm-hmm. But you can teach people your worth. And my music isn't worthless to me. So I'm not giving it away. It's not about making a ton of money. It's about it's about longevity and continuing and having a life as a musician and as an artist. Mm-hmm. It's not free. I'm not giving it away. If people want it, they can buy the record, they can buy the CD, or they can go to Bandcamp and get it. Or they can watch the videos on YouTube, but I'm not giving it away. Streaming is just a way for somebody else to become a billionaire and not the musicians. And I wish everybody would refuse to stream. You know, then we would have control of our music. But then you have these people that convince people like, oh, but if you want your music to be heard, I was like, that doesn't make any sense. What's the point of having it heard by all these people if you don't get anything out of it and you can't afford to make another record? It just doesn't make any sense.
True. I don't have any issues with the way you're doing things.
I had a conversation with somebody at Apple Music the other day, and they kept using phrases like the model. You know, I don't think your model for your career is feasible. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? I don't understand what she's talking about. Because what she does is she gets people to stream. And the funniest thing was, I said, so okay, so how do I upload my music to YouTube? She goes, you have to go to a distributor. I said, what do you mean a distributor? It's digital. You're the streaming service. Why can't I just upload it to you? She goes, no, you got to go to one of these streaming services. I'll recommend a couple. And she gave me these names. And I go, what do they do? She goes, they distribute your digital content. I said, yeah, but I'm talking to you right now. Why can't I just upload it? And then I find out that these intermediaries, these distributors, it's so funny. They're using terms that they had 30 years ago when they actually distributed records. It's just another hustle. And then I found out you have to pay to upload your music to these people so they can upload it to Apple Music and all these other and Spotify and all these, and then give it away for free.
Same way this works. Yeah.
So I gotta pay them to give my music away. And then of course there's gotta be some kind of back road mm-hmm. thing where, you know, the people that own these streaming services actually own these distributors.
Well, that's why she had recommendations.
Then she said something to me like, oh, you know, that's the only way we can control the flow of the content. Otherwise we would be overloaded with way too much stuff if people could upload it for free. And I was like, how much does it cost to upload it? They're like $100. I'm like, I just don't really see how any of this makes any sense. I wanted to have the conversation because I wanted to be educated about the whole process. But when the conversation was over, I was so flabbergasted by the whole thing. And it just reaffirmed my desire never to do that.
Well, good. I'm glad you're sticking to your guns. And like you said, it's available. People can get it. They can buy it directly from you, I assume, you have a website and it's on the Bandcamp page. I don't know if you sell it. Do you sell directly on the Bandcamp page? I'm just looking. No. So it's through your website, which is even good. Keeping it all in hand.
You know, I didn't want to restrict people that are used to doing things. You know, like Bandcamp is as close as I'll get to what people are normally used to with streaming and all that kind of stuff. So anybody who wants to, you know, listen to music on their phone, like most people do, they have access to Bandcamp. But selling the records on Bandcamp doesn't make any sense because they are getting it. Bandcamp's right. going to get cut of something that they don't have anything to do with.
Yeah, I always think it's funny every time there's a Bandcamp Friday, first of the month, everybody goes there like, what the, why are you fucking doing it here? You don't have to do it here. You can do it. Yeah. It's the one day of a month where they don't take your money. Yeah.
You know, I don't blame Bandcamp. I have a website, so I don't know why I would want to sell physical product on Bandcamp.
Right. I got you. Well, the record Rise of the Aggros has been out for a couple months. March 1st, I think, was the release date. So month and a half, and seems to be doing well. seems like people like it. I see you got the whole Aggro's Army thing. I'm noticing all the nods to Kiss that I've seen. Whether it's just your Space Ace shirt in the City Kids video or the Aggro's Army stuff, I think that's very cool. Kiss. Yeah.
And bands like Kiss are important. You know, they push everything. They push all the other bands along. They're like a giant steamroller. And all the other, you know, they blazed, bands like Kiss blazed trails, and they put our music in a much huger context that makes people aspire. You know, yeah. So you know, maybe you're not a Kiss fan, but Kiss, Kid Rock, Marilyn Manson, all these Slipknot, all these big spectacle bands, they put our music in a stadium context. They put our music in a vast popular culture context, which is important because it keeps momentum. It makes people think that it's something they want to be a part of. It, you know, it's just a culture. It's a wonderful cultural motivator, I think. And, yeah. And then on top of that, they're fucking awesome.
Yeah, they rock and it's fun. You know, that's you. I say it all the time. Sometimes people forget that music is also entertainment. It's a lot of things, but it's entertainment is one of those things.
First and foremost.
So there you have it. That was my conversation with Paris Mayhew of Agros. The song you just heard was City Kids, which we talked about quite a bit. There is a music video for both the tracks you heard today, City Kids and Chaos Magic. I'll put links to those in the show notes. Please go check them out. As you may have heard, it's an important part of what Paris does with Agros, and I think they make great companion pieces as intended. If you want to go check anything out with the band, you can check out the gettingitout.net page for Agros. It has links to everything that you need for Agros, places to pick it up, places to buy the new record, available on vinyl, CD, and digitally, of course. Thanks again to Paris for the time and conversation. It was a nice lunch break chat for me, and I hope it was good to hear for you as well, people listening. I said that a bit like a robot, and for that, I apologize. Speaking of robots, Nikola Jokic has gotten his Denver Nuggets to the NBA Finals with a sweep of LeBron James and the Los Angeles Lakers. LeBron this morning says he's not sure what he's going to do with this. Come on, man. We know you're not retiring. Skip that. Don't do that. We know you're not retired. You can't go like the last 10 years, I'm going to play with my son in the NBA. And then your son is literally 1 year away. And you go, I don't know if I'm going to do it. Nobody's buying it. And hey, I'm a big time LeBron fan. Big time. I want that guy to succeed. To me, he is the second greatest basketball player of all time. I'd argue the first if you take away guys who murdered their parents. But anyway, LeBron James is out. Anthony Davis, how are you not a number one? I don't get it. I don't know. I can't throw stones. I'm a fan of Joel Embiid and the 76ers, who Harden seems to be on his way out. This quickly turned into a basketball related podcast, as it tends to do, didn't it? Whatever. Then the Jimmy Butler led Miami Heat are on the verge of a sweep of their own, and the Boston Celtics have fucking blown it. And as a Sixers fan, that is rewarding, but not a lot. Like, it's only a little bit. It's like lessens the blow some. And when Jimmy Butler does it, there's always this sliding doors thing that we do as Sixers fans, where we're like, hey, he should have been ours. Could have been ours. We could have had him instead of Ben Simmons and Tobias Harris. And all that's true. But that's the past. We need to move on. So we need to move on with this episode as well. I need to do what I normally do and play you a song from a band, from a record that's coming out or just came out soon. I got a good idea. It's a track from Yakuza. They're a Chicago-based band. I remember finding out about these guys when I was in high school via the PRP.com. I still go there weekly, by the way, the PRP.com, and get music news. Anyway, they had this feature section that they called the learning curve. And I remember Yakuza was in there. And that's where I first learned about the sexual saxophone sounds of Bruce Lamont and this, what do we call them? Experimental Chicagoan heavy metal band. This track, Alice, is off of their new record, Sutra. So check it out. Let me know what you think. Maybe I should do a Yakuza episode. Maybe not. I don't know. It's up to you. It's not up to you. It's up to me. Let's be real. All right. That's it for this one. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.